and welcome to this, another episode of Frame and Reference. I'm your host, Kenny McMillan, and you're listening to episode 137 with Callan Green, ACS and ZCS, DP of the TV show, The Gentlemen. Enjoy.
It is funny that, like, when you start working, that's actually, let's turn this into a question. How do you balance, like, trying to continue to absorb stuff with how much work you're doing? Because you got a shit ton of, like, music videos and commercials on you, too.
Yeah. Mate, it's pretty tricky. I mean, having a kid and working as much as you do when you're doing TV drama, like, you're pretty much doing 14-hour days straight all the time, and you're pretty ruined by the weekend. So that we sit down and we watch something every now and again. But to be honest, I just kind of chill. I just sort of absorb by sort of osmosis when I can. Sure. Talking on set's generally pretty good too, but yeah, it's kind of takes a back seat. Well, at the moment, anyway.
Do you find that you know, with how fast production is these days, do you find that you need to keep up with what's? I'm taking more of the angle of, like, your commercials and stuff like that, and music videos. Like, yeah. Do you find that you need to kind of keep up with what's trending, or does that kind of just come in the brief usually?
Right. And
you
do what, some research. Cool. To be honest, you get a lot of that from Instagram, just seeing what, like, you know, I'm going to show the kids now because I'm 44 or something. So I'm still pretty, you know, yeah, a good bit of that. I definitely keep an eye on, like, what technology is going on with lenses and stuff like that. Also different remote heads and ways of moving the camera. But generally, just from each job and the research I'll put into each job, you tend to learn quite a lot, definitely more than I would, like, before, during a job anyway.
Yeah. Did you ever end up buying those Illumina primes?
Oh, right. Yeah. God, I was keen on that for a while. Man, I used to own so much cash, and then I sort of sold it all and then bought a house. So I got a little bit more onto it. Although it did me well for a while. But it was mainly when I was shooting in London. But then I started shooting car commercials overseas, and you can't really take kit with you. It was just sitting in a box being expensive and hanging out and getting dust.
It's fucking crazy how, like, what feels like 5 years ago, there was six lenses.
Oh,
and
totally.
In the past 2 years, there's like 100.
Yeah, there's a million billion lenses. They're coming out like almost every day. It's like, it's mad. I think I've realized TLS even made their own, like, set of lenses. TLS Bago. Maybe they've been around for a while, but I saw that yesterday. But yeah, there's just so many options. And some of them are pretty cool, man. I mean, Greg Fraser tends to use quite a few of the prototypes of a lot of these lenses, and they look fucking awesome.
Yeah, I really like the not a sponsor, but the Nisi primes.
The which one? Sorry,
the Nisi Cinema primes. They're like,
oh right, big. Yeah. I think I saw them at CDP the other day. Like, they're nuts, eh? Just little tiny little nano lenses. Yeah. Chuck it on S3 Pro or something like that, and whip it around on FX3, and you're good to go.
Yeah, I was talking to, I saw him at Cinegear, you know, around the Paramount lot. And they warned me because I have a C500, and they were saying they might need, or I guess Matt Duclos was saying that I should wait to, like, use them or buy them or whatever, because the reason they're so small is because that PL mount sticks out really far. And if you have internal NDs that come down,
yeah, you can scratch to get them a scratch, right?
Yeah.
That's always a problem with these. You definitely want to check them on something less expensive, so stop, right?
When I was looking you up, I found your Blogspot. First of all, somehow I'm still logged into Blogspot. That's scary.
Where the hell is that?
It's on Blogspot, dog. Your Anamorphic 5D website is still there.
Oh my God, that is like so long ago. Oh,
yeah.
Man.
But yeah. I kind of wanted to talk about that because that was 14 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. I got well into that. I used to have a set of Lomos.
Right.
And I chucked them on my 5D that I had PL mounted, and that came out with some awesome images.
Yeah, there's unfortunately all the pictures are gone, but there was the link to that one website or the music video.
All right.
And it's shocking how good that still holds up.
Yeah.
The 5D Mark II, like, when there's so much anxiety about what camera, you know, should I buy an FX3? Should I buy? And it's like, dude, you can get it used by D, and it'll still look good.
Yeah. It was kind of like shooting on print film or reversal or something, right? But if you get it right, it's awesome.
Yeah. What was the, what spurred you? It's just so interesting to me because like that whole blog, we don't have got to recount the whole thing, but like, seems, reading it now seems kind of quaint, but at the time was not an easy task to like PL mount to 5D and like rig it up and everything, when today that's pretty standard.
Yeah, it's pretty normal. Yeah. Luckily, there was this like kind of magician dude that lived in Melbourne. I was living in Sydney at the time, and he was into doing all that kind of stuff. So I sent my 5D down to him, and he ripped the guts out of it and stuck a PL mount on it. And then I was able to put my my Lomos on it. It was a lot of fun doing that.
Yeah. What kind of made you want to do that at the time? I had a D90, so I was just high from day one.
That's not good. I suppose I was in this kind of time in my career where I sort of soon after leaving film school, I wasn't really like smashing it, but I could definitely shoot. So I needed to have a kind of a bit of a niche. And the 5D Mark II coming out really, really helped me, actually. I was known as the 5D guy in Sydney for a while, I think, which is awesome. And it pissed off a lot of people because you rock up with your own kit and you're a lot cheaper. And if you can do the job, then it's wicked, right? Yeah. Just wanted to make it even better, really. Just wanted a way of it being even more cinematic or more interesting or something, another feather in your 5D bow, you could say.
Yeah. It's just interesting to me because like the dichotomy, I grew up around that. I'm 33. So, you know, it was when I was in college that came out my like freshman year. Yeah. And growing up or like learning 16 millimeter, getting digital tools, you know, like a 5D, we were on a DBX-100, but or my XL2. But trying to make things, as you said, cinematic when you didn't have film was... difficult. So I'm kind of wondering, like, at the time, what were the things that you think made a cinematic image as opposed to maybe something today that seems to have done the trick? Or is it the same set of tools?
It's pretty similar, but I suppose it was just cheaper and more available to me. So I'd say the fact that it was large format. It was, right? It was large format?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So therefore, you got a super shallow depth of field.
Which at the time was not easy to do. Sensors.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. And I remember spending about $2,000 on some crappy monitor to be able to pull the focus, but it paid off. It's a nightmare if you're going off the back of a camera. I suppose it's just that. And then be able to put on a bunch of lenses and the way it looked, it did kind of, if you got it right, look a bit kind of print film in the right light. Needed a bit of contrast, but also soft as well.
Did you end up selling the Lomos? Because those are very much back in fashion.
Mate, yeah, let's not talk about the kit that I've sold. I used to own a full set of Super Speeds plus a 65mm as well. And it's like, makes me want to cry. But I did. I sold them to my mate. I've got pretty good cash for them, to be honest, because I think I bought them for about $20,000. I sold them for 80,000 Aussie.
Damn.
So yeah, it was good. Get me going. Get the doors open.
That's a funny, like I asked I suppose a mentor of mine when I was getting started, like, hey, should I buy, I wanted to be a DB. And I was like, should I buy lenses or camera? Because everyone was saying buy lenses because it's like an investment. And he was like, do not listen to them, buy a camera. And I was like, why? And he goes, at your level, are you going to rent? And I was like, that's a good point.
Yeah. No, owning lenses is wicked. I really miss owning, kind of like my babies, but they're gone now. I also owned an F65. I had the first Sony F65 in Sydney, and that ended up being a really bad idea because just it was way too powerful way too good for how people knew how to use it. Like we'd shoot something and send it into the post house, and then just treat it like a Alexa Classic. You know, it would just come out like German gun footage from the 40s, and never have blamed they just didn't tick the box with Sony, right? Or you know, and also there's a lot of data.
Well, and then I saw on that blog that you switched to a Red One after all was said and done. Was that easier?
No, I think that was because I could borrow my mate's one. The first time I used the red one, we had to put a ice pack on it, and it kept shutting down.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, actually, what was the one after the red one? Was it the
it would have been whatever David Fincher made him make. It was the Mysterium, the DSMC one Mysterium, that when it went to the box instead of the tube.
Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah, that one, yeah. Yeah, so I managed to chuck the Lomos on that and shoot a music video on that. That was fun, and it worked well.
Yeah, what, you got a master's in cinematography?
Yeah. I left New Zealand after being a second AC for probably 5 years because I got into the AFTRS, which is the National Film School in Sydney. And they only took 4 people a year, which is kind of cool that I got it.
Oh, wow.
And then I even ended up on the news in New Zealand. Kind of how cool it was. I was shooting my first music video and I came along and interviewed me about getting into that film school. It was great. Yeah, I went to that for 2 years as full-time course and then left with a MA. Doesn't really matter having an MA other than when you try and get your visa for shooting in America.
Sure. Like that. That's actually a better question than does film school matter now? Because I was thinking about it when you're talking about like having a niche or whatever. I've interviewed a few DPs and directors. Actually, I interviewed, what's his name? Production designer for he was a production designer in Lord of the Rings, which I know you were a part of.
Yeah, I was the main unit collaborator on that second AC. Was this Dan?
He also did Power the Dog. That makes me feel bad.
Oh, you said Power of the Dog. I thought you said he powered the dog.
Oh no. Yeah, the movie Power of the Dog.
Never-ending story, isn't it?
But something that I was kind of talking to all these various people about was, from your perspective, is it easier to be a DP in terms of getting jobs, you know, moving up the ranks or whatever in Australia and New Zealand than America, or is it kind of just a smaller version of the same thing?
That's a good question, bro, because after finishing film school, I worked for quite a while as working on music videos and ads and slowly working my way up. And I think if you don't crack it really hard straight away, a lot of people kind of remember you as the guy who left film school and was slowly working his way up. And then it's quite difficult to actually really crack it and start doing the big jobs, of which there aren't many in Sydney or went back then. There were kind of maybe 3 or 4 DPs that were doing all the big jobs and everything else kind of dropped down. After I left Sydney and moved to London is really when my career took off, because I think no one really knew me. I had a couple of car commercials, and then I managed to get a pretty good car commercial with the Bridgestone tires straight away, and that took off, and that was amazing. So it's a tricky one to answer. It depends like how ballsy and how cocky you are, I think. But I wasn't really too ballsy or cocky. I just cruised along and enjoyed life, maybe too much.
Yeah, I certainly took that route.
But yeah.
After I left college, I was working at Red Bull and I was like, I'm going to live forever. And then.
Totally. Oh, man. I had a meeting with a financial advisor last week and I wish I'd had that meeting when I was 20. But hey, it's what it is, bro.
Yeah. How did you end up getting those first jobs? Was it just because you had worked on larger sets and it was kind of a word of mouth thing, or did you pivot to were you advertising yourself as a DP at this point?
I was advertising myself as a DP. They don't have agents in Australia. They've step booking services. So you'd come up as available. They'd then look at your website or your CV. But a word of mouth, I suppose, and just who you've been working with. I was pretty much shooting anything I could, commercials, music videos, pretty much anything. It's, I don't know. I'm not really sure how to answer that one. Yeah. Sorry, mate.
Well, I don't know. A lot of DPs seem to have come up, and directors for that matter, seem to have come up in like the music video scene and become, your Spike Jones, your David Fincher, whoever.
Yeah.
And Romanek. And it doesn't feel like that world really exists anymore. Like, there's probably a couple legit music videos that you could be like, look, I shot that and you should give me a job, versus now it's usually like your friend's band.
Yeah. Well, I think you definitely keep chipping away, and like everything is always leads to something else, as long as you don't cause a massive like world of pain on set. And I'm generally a pretty nice guy, worked pretty hard and did my best. But I mean, everything through my career has always been like a little jump here and a little jump there. Like when I got into film school, when I got Lord of the Rings, and then when I got my first car commercial, like. The first car commercial I had was supposed to be a documentary, and then it turned into a full blown production, Russian arm shooting in the desert outside of LA. And I was like, and then would go to China and finish it off. It was for Chevrolet. And I was like, oh, they're definitely going to kick me off. And they kept me on. So then you have a car commercial, and then suddenly you're allowed to do car commercials after that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But for instance, I was in Sydney, and Warner now, who's an English director, famous music video director, came over and he chose me to do a One Direction video there. And that was pretty big. I think the budget was about $1 million, and that just doesn't happen in Sydney. So then I had done a really good music video as well, you know. So
yeah.
You just keep on and it'll come to you. Keep smiling.
Yeah, it is kind of annoying how you have to get the job to get a job.
Oh, totally. Like, yeah.
I want to shoot car commercials. Like, what, you haven't? And you're like, yes.
Yeah, I know.
I would like to.
Yeah. Oh, man, I lost a commercial once because they were carrying a cooked chicken through the background of the shot. And apparently, they wanted to know if I'd shot something before. And I said, I haven't. And so they kicked me off and got someone else.
Oh, my good God.
And that smells fishy to me, bro. It must have been something else, but I like to think that was one.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it doesn't sound, I've heard stupider.
It's ridiculous. That's the kind of thing I do miss about shooting commercials. I haven't shot a commercial for a while. It's just the craziness of what goes on. I used to just sit there and love it, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, they're so educational, too. Like, you do so many that you get a lot of reps in.
Yeah, totally. I learned a lot about vacuum cleaners for a little while. I'm still the electric vacuum cleaners.
Perfect.
Did a lot of baby stuff. I learned about babies. Didn't help when I had a baby, but yeah.
You knew what products to get.
I did, yeah.
What was your experience like working on that, the Lord of the Rings trilogy? Were you learning a ton on that, or were you just kind of doing your job, keeping your head down? Because I assume... At the time, did anyone know that was going to blow up like it did, or was it kind of just like put your head down and work?
I was at the right time at the right place. I'd been second ACing for about a year and a half, and not on big stuff, like, you know, 16 mil commercials, local content, like nothing even close to that. I think I'd worked on a TV series with William Shatner in it, but other than that, it was nothing going on. And I got a phone call one day. I got asked if I would be interested in working on the main unit of Lord of the Rings. And we'd heard about it coming. Not everyone knew how big it was. We kind of had an idea that it was going to be pretty big because it was Peter Jackson, and he had just finished The Frighteners. And everyone thought that was big because it had Michael J. Fox in it.
Right.
But I really had no idea what I was walking into. I was 18 at the time. I remember turning up on day one to the camera prep room, and I'd never seen so many boxes in my life. I had no idea what the hell was going on because there was enough kit for three units. I think I had 48 mags in the truck and six different stocks.
Oof.
It was insane. And also, I was supposed to be the truck loader, but Jack Fitzgerald got pulled into focus pulling the third camera. So I was doing everything. His sheets, slates, loading. Yeah, it was nuts. Absolutely mental. I wish I'd had a bit more time to chill and kind of watch what was going on, but I just didn't, man. It was insanity plus for a long, long time.
Well, it's funny because I'm not a big Lord of the Rings fan. All right, this is going to piss somebody off. I've watched all whatever it is, 15 hours of this special, the documentary, you know, that comes on the extended DVDs.
Oh, yeah.
And I have
probably and a lot then.
Yeah, maybe I should. Yeah, we should go back and check it.
Yeah.
But I have not seen the first two films.
You what?
I have not seen the first two films. I've seen the entire making of documentary, and I've seen the third one.
Ah, cool. Wow, so you know how finishing.
I just saw that one in theaters. I hadn't seen the first two, and my friends were like, hey, let's go. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Did you notice that right at the end when they come back to Hobbiton, that Elijah looked really young again?
No, I mean, it's been whatever, you know, like 20 years, but did they shoot that first?
Yeah, so, it was early on. We're in Hobbiton, and we shot them at the beginning of the book one and also their return. So, yeah, we shot it all together for one and three, which I don't think had been done before. If it had, I didn't know about it.
I remember that being a thing. Like, I remember them advertising, like, oh, my God, they're shooting all three at once.
Yeah, everyone was completely mental that was working on it, but it sort of turned out, and now it's kind of a thing, right?
Yeah. Well, and what I was going to say initially before I showed my ass to however many people listen to this, it does feel like everyone who made that film, it seemed from the outside like it was an indie project that an entire nation worked on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there's about 2,000 cast and crew that worked on it, and like nothing like that had ever happened in New Zealand, and it kind of definitely was the, I'd say, the second birth of the New Zealand film industry. It was epic. I remember being at the wrap party, and I went to the toilet, and the guy next to me, I had never seen him. I go, hey man, what are you doing with the show? And he was the guy that looked after the portaloos. So, yeah, it was absolutely amazing to work on it. And I've got actually right next to me is a poster. It was from the original poster that came out before they put all the text down the bottom, and I managed to sneak one.
Oh, that's awesome, actually.
Yeah, I got Elijah to sign it for me. I did want him to sign it. He signed it, but he also wrote like a lovely message to me on it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's cool. I'll read it to it. It says, Callan, it was a brilliant journey. All of us are bonded for life. Here to the bloody ring, Elijah.
That's rad.
Yeah, man. He's a good dude.
Also, that artwork is sick.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just as a poster, that's a great poster.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really cool. It's got a kink in it, though, because I didn't fold it up probably when I put it back in the car. But yeah, whatever.
That's, you know, that's just part of the story.
Yeah, totally.
What, from there, you kind of, some time passes. I saw a ton of second unit work on your website. And
yeah,
honestly, I think second unit is more fun.
Oh, it definitely can be.
Or at least more interesting.
On the big films, I would say it's definitely more fun, for sure. So I was working on a Mercedes commercial with Mark Forster, and he was about to start doing Christopher Robin, and he asked me if I wanted to do Splinter Unit on that. So that was my kind of foray back into film and TV. So I did that. And then I got asked to do Fast 9 with Steve Winden, and that really was it. That was the clincher. So that was like 5 months work on a huge film. I think we had three cameras full time with four camera packages, and we took over Edinburgh for about 2 months. It was like, yeah. And we definitely had a lot of fun on that. Yeah. So while Steve was in the studio shooting all the chat, we were blowing stuff up and smashing drones into buildings and, yeah, some cool stuff.
It is, because it's, I feel like the thing that you don't recognize getting, you know, trying to pursue a career in cinematography is that all the fun shit that you love as a kid.
Yeah.
That's second unit.
Yeah. Done by
everything that makes you want to do this is second unit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, man, we had fun. Like when we threw the car through the whiskey shop, that was amazing. We took quite a few goes at doing that. It was an expensive shop.
Look,
yeah.
What?
And then,
go ahead.
Oh, then after that, I got went on to Masters of the Air second unit. So that was absolutely amazing because I'm super into history, and I'd actually just read the book. I listened to it. I don't really read much. Good.
I think it counts. I think it counts.
Yeah,
I'm not a pedant like that.
Yeah. But that was cool. And we did some awesome stuff on that. We killed a lot of young Americans.
That show is incredible, by the way. Like,
wicked, eh?
Congrats on that one.
What are the, was that, what were most of your shots for second unit on Masters of Air?
I was mainly in the volume unit doing, like when anything went wrong inside the B17. So it was generally, myself in the unit that we, that I was working there. Lee Morrison was my director. He was the stunt coordinator. And we also did what's called a rotisserie where we're outside and it would, it could spin 360 and also come up on its end. And unlike some fairground ride, that was really hard to shoot in. I don't operate. I wasn't operating on those jobs. So I just send the guys in and sit there and watch it.
Had you worked on a volume before?
I did a couple of times. I think a music video and a car commercial. But this was definitely the biggest volume I'd ever seen. There were two volumes. One was kind of like a concave, kind of long and concave, so you could shoot the B-17 in profile. It didn't quite, the fuselage didn't quite fit. We either had to have the front on it or the tail on it, cockpit or tail. And then we had a separate gimbal rig just for the cockpit. And that was like enclosed in volume. And that's where all the piloting of the planes was shot.
Yeah. Do you, it's, you know, there's a lot of like, just in general, not even in film, there's just so many new technologies that come out and everyone, you know, like fucking Bitcoin. Everything, crypto's going to change the world. And then it does for 10 minutes and then everyone. Do you see the volume as something that like, because it's a tricky thing, like just in logistically.
It really is, man. And there's, and look, there's probably, there's going to be people that are listening to, your, to this that have done like heaps of it and they know it inside out, but it really is a bit of a beast that you need to know how to tame and how to use it properly and what it works for and when it doesn't work. I was in the volume stage yesterday shooting Games of London with cars, and I've since realized that tinting on windows in new cars is a freaking disaster if you have more than two people in a car. So it's something I didn't pay enough attention to at the beginning, and I really wish I had, because it was just too late by the time I got into it. You just cannot make that look good.
Because it's the, it's that, if I'm correct, it's that like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like probably five stops of light you'd lose. And when you're in a volume stage, I don't generally use the volume to completely light what I'm doing. I use it for effects and a bit of ambience, but it is just impossible if you're shooting something in the back of a car and you want a full shot or something looking in there.
But, and what was, would it have just been too difficult to roll the windows down and put it in later?
Look, that is a good question. Probably could have, is something that was brought up and I thought we're already down walking down this road. I think we should just crack on. I mean, sure. It's when I say it doesn't look great, it doesn't mean it looked horrible. It's just, I'm pretty anal about making things look good, you know.
Yeah,
it's a lot easier when you have a car that isn't tinted, I'll tell you that.
Well, and initially when you said the tinted, I just immediately thought you meant like green magenta, like there was like a film, not like literal privacy tinting.
No, the privacy tinting, and it was like really great as well. So it was a nightmare. We're putting lights through it, we're adding magenta to those lights, and then, God. But also they had to get in and out of the car as well. So that was whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and when the, I remember when the Mandalorian first came out and everyone was like, this is the future. And they were like,
yeah.
I remember a bunch of people going like, you don't have to light. And I was like, what are you talking about? They're like, it'll do it. I'm like, it's not bright enough. Have you been lit by a screen before? Like,
Look, I think it definitely matters on the size of the screen and also if it's a day or night shot and what's going on in like in the volume. But I was adding quite a bit of light to these castings in the last few days. And I was really happy with how it turned out. But finding that happy medium of interactive light and still being able to see them enough to be able to, you know, pull their skin tone out and their eyes are lit. And on Masters of the Air, we were lighting inside the plane seats and from outside. And we had a sun on a crane, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. 9K being the sun, all of that. You need to have a lot of interactive lighting, really, of your own, too.
Totally. Were you doing any like because I know, who was I talking to that was shooting on like one of the, oh, I think it was the DP from The Mandalorian, but he was saying that they would just put like sometimes just a white square, digital white square just somewhere in the volume to give it some.
It's brilliant. And lots of people don't know you can do that stuff. You can create all kinds of shapes, and you can make them strobe, or you can make them pulse. So yesterday I had a massive rectangle in between the top of the windscreen and the roof of the car, and just added like the sun pulsing through the trees. It's cool. You need the person operating the volume to be as onto it as they can be, really, because if they're not, they're going to take too long, or they're going to do it wrong. So it's kind of like being in a tracking vehicle. You need everyone to be in, you know, cohesion.
Right. You know? Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Kind of sounds smart.
I do it all day.
Just trying.
Does it end up being, not like with specific numbers, but does it end up being cheaper overall, or is it more just a workflow consideration that it makes it easier in some way, or besides just going out and driving around, you know?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely, depends on where you shoot. I mean, some volume stages are so expensive, but it's definitely better than on a low loader driving around in all kinds of weather conditions with the sun changing direction every time you're around, and having to get traffic control and all of that. I mean, it's not fast. This is the thing that people need to know. They think, oh, we're in the volume state, it's all good, just rock out, turn it on. You need a prep day, you need to go through everything, you need to set all your lighting, you need a great board operator and a volume operator. But I would say yes. We went through probably 5 pages of stuff in 4 different cars yesterday in one day.
Oh,
there's
really?
No way you're never going to do that on a low loader.
Yeah. So longer prep, but more time shooting versus longer day, less time shooting.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it does look better once you get it right. It definitely looks better. Unless you've got prep faster.
Before getting into the gentleman, which is sick, by the way. I had to ask, New Zealand's worst commercial?
Oh, yeah.
What was the worst commercial ever made that you were...
Oh, man, that's not the worst ever. I think it was the worst in... when was it? It would have been 1993. Yeah. In New Zealand, there's this show called Fair Go, and they used to have a show every year where they have like New Zealand's worst commercial and like go through all of them. I was in it. It was my brother used to do quite a bit of acting. This is kind of how I partly got into the film industry. I'd already found a love of photography after my mum bought me a little secondhand camera.
Sure.
And my brother used to do a bit of acting, and I thought, oh, that'd be cool. I'll give that a go. And I managed to score a commercial, and it was a sanitarium peanut butter commercial, and I don't know if you have sanitarium, but it's like New Zealand's most famous peanut butter, and the ads used to be pretty cheesy. And I was
Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff. Jeff is awesome. And I was playing a character, a kid walking around on a golf course driving range, picking up golf balls and getting hit in the head with the helmet on. And because of such a hard day that I had, I needed to sit down and eat a... peanut butter sandwich at the end of it.
Right.
But yeah, it was on that job. I got to see a real film camera. It was a Arri BL 1000-foot mag, 18-100 century zoom, and a 6x6 matte box. And I thought, wow, that is awesome. And this is the guy that was so cool. The guy standing next to the camera, which I think was a grip, I asked him, how do you get into the film industry? And his answer was, a lot of hard work, mate.
Yeah.
And so that was when it started.
What made it the worst commercial, though?
It was just a shit script, I think. And I mean, guys, they're walking around picking up golf balls, getting hit in the head, and sit down after a hard day and eat a sandwich.
After a hard day of getting hit in the head with a golf ball, it's time for a sandwich.
Yeah. Yep. It's a hard life, mate. Someone's going to do it.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it, because it was just like a byline on something. And I was just like, was it just shot shit? But yeah, that is a pretty
good, I think, for the time. Yeah.
So with the gentleman, you did the last four episodes?
Correct. Yeah, I did episode 5 through 8.
And Guy Ritchie directed the first two.
Yeah.
Of the whole thing.
Yeah, and Ed Wild was the lead DP on 1 and 2.
So what was the conversation between... It does feel like whenever there's a project helmed by kind of a known director that's a series, it does end up usually being, it seems, the first couple episodes set the tone.
Yeah,
then,
absolutely.
So what were the conversations like when they were set? Were they setting up the look without you and then you were fulfilling it? Or were you involved in those early conversations?
Aaron came onto the job only, I think, a week or two before I did. Aaron Creevy, the director of Lot 3, so episode 5 and 6. And so he was as new to it as I was, really. So with himself and Laura Jackson, our block producer, we were luckily able to watch episode 1 or an early cut of it anyway. So we got to check that out and I was like, holy shit, this is so fucking good.
Yeah.
And then we're like, after going, wow, this is amazing, we were working on such a cool show, we then went, ah, shit, we've got to do as good as that.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck. I'm sorry if I'm not allowed to swear.
No, you're good. You can say the fuck word here.
Okay. Cool, man. Yeah, so we watched that. Ed had also drawn up like a couple of pages of PDF of what Guy really likes, kind of angles that he's into. Generally, it was what not to do. And so that's your kind of base plan to stick with.
That makes my notes far more interesting. What are you not supposed to do on a Guy Ritchie project?
I mean, for instance, he doesn't like direct over shoulders. He likes to be back a bit further or be a clean single. His profiles, he wants to see one eye, not two or three quarters of an eye or anything like that. And it was generally just a look for this show. I wouldn't say it's, I couldn't tell you if it's in general what he likes or doesn't like, but it was more of a base look for that.
Well, because as I was watching it, I noticed there were some, I guess what I didn't, when I think of Guy Ritchie, I primarily think dialogue, but since I was watching it, you know, trying to see it, there were some Ritchie-isms, you know, like your random slow-mos,
We
attaching cameras to shit, you know?
Yeah. Oh, man, we put cameras on all kinds of stuff. It was great. The FX3 was brilliant for that.
Oh, did you shoot FX3 on this?
No, we shot Sony Venice and Takina the Primes, actually.
Those are amazing lenses.
They're really good, especially for the price. I think I think Ed owned a set. He's a very smart man. And
heavy, though. We're
gonna, pretty. Yeah. They're kind of like Master Primes, aren't they?
Yeah.
And we chucked a black satin, half black satin filter on it, which worked well until you had like exposed bulbs and stuff like that. The halation was too much. So you'd knock it down to a quarter or just take it out.
Yeah. I was talking to Eric Messerschmidt about Ferrari, but also the Killer. And on the Killer, he said they used this program called Scatter,
okay,
which is a diffusion plugin for Resolve.
Oh, no way.
And so I reached out to him because, you know, it's kind of expensive. And I was like, can I write an article about this? Because on a good day, I'm a journalist. And they were like, yeah, here's a year subscription, whatever, you know, here's a year. And I'm telling you, man, it's because I hate that too. When you have like a strong light or you're getting something from the side or a bulb in the frame and now it's like way too aggressive.
Yeah.
With Scatter, you can literally just, you know, you pick any filter, they look exactly correct. I mean, it's so close. So you pick what filtration you want, what strength, but also if you want, you just key out something. You could put like a
area.
Yeah, just key out the area or put like a different strength in just that area or what, you know, whatever you want, because it's a Resolve plugin.
Oh, mate, that's wicked. I suppose you'd kind of want to be able to test it on set, I suppose. How would you do that?
Just shoot it because you're not shooting filtration. Just take any footage. Shoot regular tests and then just drop it in.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Just tell me that. Can it do this? There's can it work on a location where you're not allowed to use haze, but you really want to use haze? Because I know they've got the smog filters or whatever.
The smog filters are in there.
Yeah. They work all right. right? They're not the same LA, but
yeah.
Can it do that?
It can. I mean, it can't fake haze. It's literally just a filtration emulation.
Oh, right.
But, you know, there is a, this is going to get nerdy. There's a depth map effect, basically, in Resolve that I've started using a lot for, instead of setting windows, you know, which sometimes you get that halo or you can't get pull like a good key on someone's face or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's a depth map option that you drop in, and it creates some, I don't know how it reads it, some signs, and it creates essentially a perfect key, because the subject, unless the subject's somewhere else, but like usually the subject's right up front. So you just drop the depth map in, and then you can affect, you know, whatever's closest gets the effect, or whatever coloring or lighting, whatever you're doing, and whatever drop falls off is more natural. But I suppose you could invert it and drop the smoke filter from scatter just only in the background.
Oh man.
And that might be like a haze thing.
Yeah. That sounds wicked. I like it.
Well, now they better give me 2 years for free.
Totally, bro.
Yeah, I deserve it. But yeah, so like we're going back to the idea of like the types of shots, attaching things to people, the slow-mo shots, a lot of movement as well, you know.
Yeah, we wanted to, there's always going to be the nod to sort of guys, sort of crime genre style. I mean, you can get away with so much too, because you just have such an awesome base for what you want to be able to do. We definitely want to move the camera around a lot. I think like, so there's one scene in the boxing ring in Susie Glass's gym where on paper it just read Susie and Eddie are watching a boxing match between her brother, and she's really excited.
Yeah.
If, you know, we got the phantom camera out, and then we pulled off the guy when he hit the canvas, and we went straight into their face. And there's actually a lot of stuff that we did that got cut out because it was too Guy Ritchie, and I think he didn't like it.
It became a little pastiche.
I suppose so. Yeah, maybe. But we had a lot of fun doing it. So, you know, it was cool.
That's the scene with Guz Khan, right?
Oh, my God, that guy is so cool. Yeah, like us, you know, when Guz gets punched by Susie's brother. What's his name? The other Glass. Jack Glass. Guz gets hit and he falls backwards, and then the music kicks in, and it's kind of like, 48 frames. That was a lot of fun to shoot.
Yeah. Also, I only knew that guy because of Taskmaster. I don't know if you ever watched Taskmaster, but
I haven't. No, but I'm a huge fan of Guz now, man. I'll tell you that after working with him.
You can look up there's a Taskmaster in New Zealand, so you've got a local one, but the UK one is like the original. It's literally just like five comedians or actors or whoever, and they have to just do tasks. Like that's the game for points that don't matter.
Yeah.
The tasks are absurd. It's so fucking funny, dude. But that is another, that kind of 48 frame fall down, definitely another Ritchie-ism, as it were.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun that. Yeah, we actually had to shoot out another day because they had to build the rig and we had to move on to another set. So we came back for that. It was, I'm glad we did it because it almost got scrapped just for time.
Yeah. Did you end up, because like there's one shot in a caravan that's very Snatch.
Yeah. Oh, when the daytime scene where they're all sitting around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun.
Was that an objective reference or did that just happen to kind of?
I think that was pretty much written into the script that they're all sitting there, and then just the position of Eddie and Susie sitting at one end and then all the family at the other. Mm. But I'll tell you what, man, shooting in traveler's caravans is probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life.
Really?
They're kind of one of a kind. We couldn't cut them up. There's mirrors absolutely everywhere. They're not that big, and they're also covered in plastic. So where it's not mirrors, it's shiny bits.
Right.
And then you chuck about 13 people in there, and there's nowhere to put a camera. But we got through it. But the night scene in the Traveler's Caravan, the first time where where Eddie has an argument with the head of the Travelers, that was really hard. And that was night one for me shooting straight into the fire.
What was the kind of, because the show is incredibly, I have to always think about when people shoot in the UK, because I'm always like, oh, the lighting is so even. It's like, no, it's just overcast all the time.
Yeah.
That's not a choice.
Yeah, it's definitely not as sunny as some places, that's for sure. It feels like it's been raining for about six years at the moment. But yeah, well, I mean, we got smashed by the weather, to be honest. We had all kinds of stuff going on, and we pretty much just had to roll with whatever we got. We woke up, I think, on the fourth morning. We were supposed to shoot the Traveler's Arrival, and it had snowed really heavily overnight, and no one had seen it coming either. It wasn't even on the weather report. Like, there was a good few inches. So everything.
You're looking at the call sheet like, is this the right day?
Yeah, the call sheet was fucking covered in snow. It was, yeah, so we had a bit of an emergency meeting at breakfast, and then decided to crack on. We managed to shoot the opening to Epps. Or it's probably scene four now. It used to be an opening, but when Eddie's just standing there looking out of the Halstead Manor towards the snow, but that worked really well.
Yeah. What was the kind of, I suppose, general lighting approach? Because it does feel kind of like your classic, you know, soft key, but kind of thing. But it feels like you were probably pretty nimble with everything. Or is that just an illusion and you had to use a ton of lights?
A bit of both, because a lot of the times we were shooting in pretty big rooms, you know, like the way to Halstead Manor is huge. So we would either have a couple of 18s on a machine outside, or what I preferred was about 24 vortexes.
I love the vortexes. I got one behind this door.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it gives you such a nice look, and if you can get them close enough, it just looks brilliant. And then obviously you can adjust whatever you want. And also then you can chuck it up for a moonlight when you go outside to do your night stuff. But generally we'd have big soft key, passive sort of front bill, and then a bit of a sidey light and a bit of a backlight sometimes. Eddie, Theo James is actually quite tricky to light. His eyes are quite deep set in his head. Good looking guy, but he's quite hard to light. And he knows it too, and he'll come and tell you early on, and you go, like, you know, just keep an eye on my eyes, bro. I think he gets annoyed if you can't see his eyes, fair enough. So yeah, it took a couple of days to figure that one out as well.
But he probably gets notes. Hey, can you look up more? Can you look up more?
Yeah. But he quite enjoys coming and watching the take afterwards, to be honest, and he'll ask for one if he feels he needs it. Yeah.
Was the key there just to get things angled correctly, or were you employing like an eye light in general?
Sorry, what's the question?
Do you, like, for situations like that, is it just about like angling the light correctly, or were you employing a specific eye light?
Would generally have a light a bit closer to the camera than I normally would, and a little bit lower. So we were using the Cineos, which are like the weatherproof versions of the 360, but they're not made by Arri.
Right.
So we'd have that pretty much just off camera, and then sometimes through an 8 by T-bar. And that seemed to do it. That worked well. We'd have, for the night stuff, sometimes we'd have a big gem ball or something like that. Susie, Kaya's skin and face really lit up when you chucked a gem ball on it.
Looked sure.
Amazing. Yeah. It was quite light.
This comes up on every single interview, so I'm going to bring it up. Yeah. And they actually are my friends. Did you end up using a Steratubes?
Yeah, we did, but...
there they are.
We did. Yeah, we did, bro. We did, but differently to what I had used them in the past, we'd used them with the snap bags. And then after that, I think they started creating crates for the snap bags as well. So it'd be like a 2-foot softbox. Or a 4-foot softbox, and I'd do that a lot. Sometimes we'd put 2 4-foots together, and that would work really well. It's still, very handy, especially for eye lights.
And so you were using those primarily as keys, or were you lighting the room with those?
Generally wasn't lighting the room with those. We just went in spaces that would light a room with that kind of, that kind of lamp, really. We're generally bigger from outside, or just a bit bigger in general, or bright lights. We use the next pole, the MYX poles.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The aperture ones or whatever.
Yeah. That's super handy. Oh, great.
Yeah. Those bulbs and like the little MC pucks, or like, you know, whatever, the little magnetic.
Oh, yeah.
Those things are rad.
Is it Rusco? Do they do the little dash dots? And you've got the hydro panels?
I have that's a box of hydro panels right there.
Really?
Mate, yes.
A good lamp, man. They are so good. Yeah. My board operator likes them a lot too because he says they're easier to connect or whatever they call it.
Yeah. Well, and like the case charges them. You know, obviously you can use the iPad.
Yeah.
They're awesome. How are you using them primarily? Just for smaller spaces?
Smaller spaces. Yeah. Pretty much just small spaces. I've got a dash dot at home and I've not been able to use it yet. The only time I've ever used it is when we had someone come around and I turned it on to the police boat and I told them that the cops were there.
Sure. You know what's funny is, so there's a camera supply store called Film Tools over here. And they had just a bunch of lights out on the floor. And so one day I walked in there with my color meter and I just metered everything. Just to see like what lights are actually good. Like sky panels don't actually, I've said it a few times and I hope Ari doesn't listen.
Yeah.
But sky panels aren't like the best. Like Vortex is actually, Kino LEDs are by far the most accurate, beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Is that the SL and the SL2?
Is that what
they are? Is that the SL1 and SL2?
No, it's the Freestyle, the Diva. Oh, okay. They're all exactly the same. Any of the Kino LEDs are really the same. It's just different housings, basically.
Oh, cool. Well, it's good to know. I was still smashing it. I've always felt sad for all those Kino bulbs lying around, wherever they are.
I had so many.
In Arizona, maybe.
You know what's nice, actually, is a few years ago, because I had a Diva kit. The initial point I was going to say was the Rosco, actually, the dash, incredibly good output. I was surprised at how smooth that spectral output is how accurate it is. But what was nice was Kino needs parts for those fluorescent fixtures to fix other like broken ones, and just they don't have any because they don't make them anymore. So they gave me like a 60% discount on the new LED panels if I would just trade in my old fluorescent ones, because they needed them for parts. And I'm sitting there going like, how much of this do you need? And they're like, you can take whatever you want out of that box because we just need the parts. And I was like, amazing. They're the best company.
Everywhere. You think I'd just be sitting in a box somewhere and everyone was like lighting store or whatever.
Well, that's the thing is I think there's a lot of rental houses that probably still have them, but they're not going to give them back. You know?
Yeah. True.
What's happening is the rental houses are sending the fixtures into Kino to get fixed. So they need they need mine to replace them, basically.
Right. That's wicked. Yeah, jump on eBay and try and buy some old Kino kit.
Yeah. They did produce like a nice light.
Yeah.
It did light.
We used it on Lord of the Rings a lot, that's for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
I figured that would have just been all tungsten all the time.
No. Pretty sure we had, it was a lot of Kino. I remember the Diva light was used quite a bit to get under Ian McKellen's hat.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I might be wrong, bro, but I don't think that.
It was a while ago.
Yeah. 22 years ago.
What kind of, when you were outside, you know, I noticed that obviously we were talking about the weather kind of screwing you guys up, but how do you shape overcast or do you even bother? Because there's like some direct sun stuff that looks kind of untouched as well.
Yeah. Well, you kind of got to, Look, I try and inside light or backlight when I can just to keep you out of trouble, really, for crane shadows or camera shadows or boom shadows. Mm. And so even if it's going to be overcast, I still plan it as if it's going to get sunny because you never know. The cloud's going to pop open and if you're facing the wrong direction, you're in the shit. To shape that, I'll chuck in like a 12 or something like that. Just to get a bit of drop off on the
12 by what?
Negative?
What? Yeah, that's what I call it. You just dropped out for a second, so I didn't hear.
Sorry. Yeah. So yeah, I'd use like a 12 by negative, or depending how big it can be. If we're walking with it, can be an 8 by 8 feet. Don't do it. Yeah. When I was working in China, and I asked for an 8 by, and they freaked out because they thought I wanted 8 by 8 meter.
Oh yeah.
So you'd pretty much do that. Just keep it pretty chill, really. Or we'd use those cineos to add a little bit of highlight and just chill in the eyes. drop a bit of white on the floor if you need to. But generally on overcast day, you don't need to do too much. And even on overcast day, keeping it backlit, you still get a bit of backlight, you know. Sure.
And just you, I mean, you either see it or like, I guess the Sunseeker.
Yeah. Which, yeah, until it doesn't, and there's bloody lying to you. I don't trust mine too much anymore. I've always got to check with other people now.
The mine, because I have an Android, I don't use Sunseeker, the app. It's like another version of it. And it always tells me it needs to like calibrate. Like you pointed to the sun and it's just whipping around. I'm like, that doesn't steep.
Yeah, totally. Man, it's nothing worse setting up and then realizing that on the recce it was completely backwards.
Oh, jeez. Has that happened?
No, I've got to the end of the recce and I had to go up to the director and go, hey, look, I'm sorry, mate, but that was completely wrong what I told you. The sun's actually over there. Yeah, but now I bring in the gaffer, and so at least I can share the responsibility of totally fucking it up.
Yeah. How long was the shoot for the show? Was it a pretty compact schedule?
For the gentleman?
Yeah.
I think it was about 5 weeks per et. I think it was like 20
minutes. That's not terrible.
No, it was good. I think I may have had slightly longer on block one, but I'm pretty sure we got down to about 28 days on block four.
Still decent.
Yeah, no, it was all right. Yeah, I think we're shooting sort of between 3 and 5 pages a day. Sometimes we'd get a 6 if we're in one space, or down to 2 if we're moving around. But it was generally between 3 and 5.
Yeah, when having like a nice schedule does that afford you anything logistic? I mean, obviously not logistically like shooting, but like in your management style, like are you able to kind of, as David Lynch would say, like get dreamy with it and like think about stuff, or is it kind of still get going just with, you have more time?
Definitely still under the pump, you know, because like some people want more takes or for whatever reason you get held up. I mean, 3, 4, 5 pages a day, it's still pretty quick, I think.
Yeah.
But also because it's got like that kind of style to it, you do need to put effort into shooting with a bit of emotional energy. You can't just like smash it out. I mean, obviously we had to every now and again when we're totally running out of time, but yeah, it did allow us to give a little bit more energy into the visual storytelling.
Sure. Was there anything, because I realized recently, and after 140 episodes of this thing, I've never really gotten into the management position of being a DP. It's always been lighting and cameras and whatnot.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's just such an important part. I'm like, that was a blind spot. I should have started this earlier. But I kind of wanted to know, was there anything that you learned from any like mentors, or anything that you've carried on to the way that you run a team, or anything that maybe some advice you have for people?
I think from being a camera assistant, the second AC was really just like work your butt off, keep your head down, be nice to people. I think for DP wise, Steve Winden was actually probably one of the biggest influences that I've worked with, because he's just such a lovely guy. He's working on like Fast and Furious 9 or 10, and it's like you're at the pub with him, you know. It's just such a good dude. Other than that, not really. I think just in general, I seem to be a pretty happy-go-lucky kind of person. I just try and treat people with respect. And as long as you're trying your best, then I'm cool. You know, I'm happy. It's when people piss around and take, you know, joking around on their phone when they need to be doing something.
Right.
And, you know.
Are you in the position in your career where you're able to, like, bring your crew from set to set, or is it someone else making those decisions?
No, yeah, I was on Gangs of London, because I was the lead DP, I was able to pick my crew. And sadly, because of the strikes, I had sort of the pick of London, to be honest. So we had an amazing crew on that. But when you're a block DP, you don't really get too much say in your crew, unless someone's leaving. Or maybe your second unit DP, you can have a bit of say in. Other than that, you just sort of give them what you give them. But I mean, the crews here are awesome. Everyone's lovely. You don't really get dicks anymore, I've noticed.
I've heard that era of like stomping around angry, yeah, like DPs, producers, other crew, whatever, is kind of dead. And I think it's cell phones, but we can film it now.
Yeah. Yeah. I never thought of that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the Panopticon effect.
Yeah. 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 Oh man. Yeah. Those days are pretty much over. You still see it every now and again, but it's nowhere near as full on as it used to be. I've seen some shit in like in the late '90s, early 2000s, but it's all pretty chill now.
Yeah. It is funny. Like, you know, the joke is always like, we're not curing cancer here. Like why? Why did, yeah, it's, I mean, it's stressful, obviously, but it's, well, I guess that's truly the answer, is most people don't have, especially back then, don't go to therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, therapy is a good thing, especially if you're in a, you know, a crazy position like, you know, DP.
Yeah.
Operating.
Say again.
Or focus pulling or operating or gaffing. I mean, the whole industry is pretty intense, really, isn't it?
Focus pulling, especially. Like, everyone wants to shoot full frame at a 1.4.
Yeah.
You're just like,
Yeah, and never, ever, well, we certainly on the show I'm on at the moment, we're not getting any rehearsals, or almost never. Maybe 90% of the time we shoot the rehearsal. And it just makes me think of that cat. What is that? You know, that cat, the rehearsal cat?
Rehearsal cat?
Yeah, have you not heard of rehearsal cat?
No.
Maybe I have to send it to you.
Oh, okay. Like
thought it was well known. Maybe not.
Maybe it's, I'm also like admittedly ignorant about a lot of things. So it could be popular and I just have no idea.
Wait.
But yeah, you can DM that to me.
Well,
I see that we're going over. I know it's later for you than me.
Oh, it's all good, man. It's all good.
So I'll let you go, but definitely, would love to have you back on, talk about the new show, and honestly, probably get more into Masters of Air. I like touched on it and then didn't even,
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But,
I've been so lucky to work on such cool stuff recently, especially I've not been in TV drama very long, you know, maybe 4 years. So it's been absolutely amazing. And so it's been talking to you, mate. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Appreciate it, dude. Yeah. We'll stay in touch. I just added you on the old gram. So,
wicked.
Yeah. Cool. All right, man. Take care, and thanks again for hanging out.
Thanks, Kenny. See you, mate.
Frame and Reference is an Owlbot production. It's produced and edited by me, Kenny McMillan, and distributed by Pro Video Coalition. As this is an independent podcast, we rely on support from listeners like you. So if you'd like to help, you can buy me a coffee by going to frameandrefpod.com, and there's a little button to buy me a coffee. That's also where you can find video versions of this podcast or audio, depending on how you're doing it now. Thank you so much. See you next time.